Good afternoon. I'm First Assistant Attorney General Melanie Snyder, Attorney Registration Number 35835, representing the appellant Barbara Broll, Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Revenue. With me on the briefs in this case and here today are Assistant Attorneys General Allison Blair and Michael Shea. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time today for rebuttal. May it please the court, House Bill 1300 represents the General Assembly's intent to expedite the fair and complete resolution once and for all of hundreds of conservation easement tax credit disputes with millions of dollars at issue. To this end, revenue seeks to ensure that any taxpayer whose tax liability is at stake is properly joined to the district court action because this will ultimately determine whether they're bound by the judgment in that action. Revenue expects to recover a substantial amount of tax, interest, and penalties owed through judgments against hundreds of transferee taxpayers. These judgments will be useless if they're not enforceable. The district court's order should therefore be reversed for two reasons. First, in finding that transferee taxpayers are somehow not taxpayers for purposes of these credits, the order contradicts the plain language of the statutes. Second, because the finding that transferees are not taxpayers drove the district court's order, the court erred in then finding that transferees are not necessary parties that must be joined and served in accordance with the rules of civil procedure. To the first issue of whether transferee taxpayers are taxpayers, they are. The district court's order is contrary to the plain language of the statute, which requires a finding that all taxpayers are liable for any deficiencies that flow from their individual credit claims. The statutory construction proposed by the Appellee Tax Matters representatives, I'll call them the TMRs today, simply doesn't make sense. We're talking about a very valuable state income tax credit, $260,000 for each of the 14 donations in this case, and currently $375,000 allowable for a qualified donation. As a result, these statutes must be strictly construed. Tax deductions and exemptions are accorded as a matter of legislative grace and are not allowed unless clearly provided for. The TMRs have failed to demonstrate that transferees are somehow exempt from tax liability for deficiencies that flow from their own credit claims. They cite no authority in support of this novel assertion that would result in the extraordinary shift of tax liability from one taxpayer to another. The plain language of the statute provides that any taxpayer who claims a credit for the donation of a conservation easement that's contrary to law shall be liable for deficiencies that flow from that claim. As this court stated last week in the Shaw construction case, the word any used as an adjective in the statute means all. And this makes sense here because the statute allows for the transfer of these credits from a donor taxpayer to a transferee taxpayer. Subsection 9 of the statute makes clear that any taxpayer who ends up claiming a credit will be liable for any deficiencies that flow from their own credit claim.
Shouldn't we interpret the word taxpayer in paren 9 consistent with its definition in paren 1?
Absolutely.
So you may want to address paren 1.
Certainly. So subsection 1 sets forth and lists the taxpayers that are eligible to both donate and claim a conservation easement tax credit. That the limiting language in that subsection that discusses and modifies the pass-through entities that are listed there and refers to the language regarding pass-through entities that donate as an entity, that modifying phrase modifies only the pass-through entities. It doesn't modify the entire list of taxpayers.
Because it wouldn't make any sense, is your position.
Exactly.
Okay. Your time is so limited here, Ms. Snyder, if I may interrupt your train on the first piece. I would really like to hear what you have to say on the second argument. You started in your introduction, and you say throughout your brief that the only way to bind the transferees is to join them. And I guess I'm curious as to why you say that. There is seems to me a pretty good argument that the legislature intentionally created this mechanism for representative parties, just like in other contexts with a class representative in a class action and other cases. It really seems to me that a pretty good argument that's what the legislature's intent was. And the transferees presumably did these deals knowing darn well there's a whole system for TMRs and they're going to be represented by somebody else. Given that, why is it necessarily true that the transferees have to be joined to be bound? Why can't the legislature create a situation where a TMR represents their interest and they agreed to be bound by whatever happens in that litigation when they did this deal?
The legislature certainly could provide for that type of a system. The issue here is that the provisions of the TMR that establish the TMR and transferee relationship that you're referring to in subsection 7I and J of the statute, those provisions do not confer personal jurisdiction over the transferees. And without personal jurisdiction, the transferees in theory may be bound by the court's decisions on, let's say, the validity or the value of the credit. The problem is that the judgment that actually determines the transferee's individual tax liability is not going to be binding or enforceable unless that transferee is joined and served and made a party to the action.
But why? I mean, the statute specifically says the transferee is going to be bound by the result of the litigation between the TMR and the department. So why, I hear you say that, but I'm not understanding why.
Sure. I think it's important to point out that the House Bill 1300 creates broad jurisdiction for the district courts in these cases. And so the issues are not limited to just the validity and the value of the credit. Subsections H and I of subsection 2 discuss the ability of the district court to hear all claims and defenses that touch the regularity of the proceedings. So it's important to remember that a transferee may have issues that are unique claims and defenses that are beyond the scope of the validity or value of the credit, and that may relate only to revenues assessment, so the actual issuance of the notice of deficiency to that taxpayer. And that's wholly apart from the validity or the value of the credit that they actually claimed. So, for example, they may have an estoppel defense. You can imagine a situation where a taxpayer is audited by the Department of Revenue and on an issue completely unrelated to the conservation easement tax credit, and they're successful in reaching a settlement with the department, and they close out that tax year. If the department were then to go and issue a notice of deficiency regarding a claim of a conservation easement tax credit in that same year that had been closed out in the settlement, for example, I think perhaps the transferee would have an estoppel-related defense. And that's not something that a TMR would have any reason to know about.
Wouldn't that be, number one, isn't that why we have a mechanism to intervene as a matter of right? And number two, wouldn't the transferee in that hypothetical you gave us be barred under res judicata? Claim preclusion.
Perhaps. The problem with relying on intervention is that we don't know how long we'll have to wait for these transferees to intervene, and we might risk that it won't be timely. If we have an issue that a transferee has that could be dispositive to the entire case, we don't want to move through the validity and the value and the apportionment phases only to have a transferee at the late hour come forward and say, actually, the department's just stopped from moving forward against me. And they could have purchased the entire amount of the credit, and that could make the entire case go away.
Couldn't you have the district court simply issue an order as to outside time limit for intervention?
Perhaps.
That would solve your problem.
It would solve the problem, perhaps, of transferees that are on notice of the proceeding and that know about all the claims and defenses. The only problem, an additional problem that it might create, is that a transferee may have a transferee, because their tax liability will be decided by these cases, should have at least the opportunity to come and participate and raise claims and defenses. And that means, and that's relevant at every stage of the proceeding. So if they want to go and hire and retain their own appraiser, for example, at the value stage, if they don't want to trust their TMR to prove up the value, or they want to retain another expert to discuss why the actual appraisal does meet the standards that are required for a qualified appraisal, they need to have the opportunity to be able to do so. And we can't rely on piecemeal intervention from transferees, particularly when we're dealing with hundreds in some of these cases.
Your brief, and the same would be true of your opponent's brief, does not make any reference to legislative history. May we assume that you've examined it and found nothing in there that would be informative?
That's correct, Judge Webb. We have listened to the legislative history, and we haven't found any testimony that would support the TMR's positions or anything that would be contrary to revenue's interpretations of the statutes.
Without asking you to concede any of your points, let's assume that we agreed with Judge Gabriel's viewpoint. That the statute simply makes the transferees bound by litigation involving the donors. Do we even need to reach the definitions of taxpayer and the provision for taxpayer liability in paren 1 and paren 9?
Yes, that's the threshold decision that you have to reach today.
Now, why do we have to decide that if we could affirm the district court on another ground, which is there's no Rule 19 issue here because of the statutory provision that the transferees are bound?
Because that will guide the courts and the litigants to be able to explain what type of case we need to make out. If you find today that somehow transferees have no tax liability and that only the donors have tax liability, that's a fundamental.
I think I was asking the converse, and if I did it inartfully, I apologize. Let's assume we conclude that your Rule 19 argument has no merit because the statute provides that transferees are bound by litigation involving the donor. You understand the assumption?
Yes.
Okay. If that's our holding, why do we need, or do we need to address the definitions of taxpayer in paren 1 and taxpayer liability in paren 9?
Yes, I think you still do.
Why?
Because at the end of the day, that will be the judgment that the district court's going to enter is going to apportion the tax that is due from each taxpayer. And so if you determine, or you don't give any guidance about which taxpayers in these cases are liable, we won't know. Are we apportioning $260,000 of tax owed to the TMR, owed by the TMR, or are we parsing out $20,000 should be apportioned to transferee number one and $40,000 to transferee number two? So it's critical guidance that this court needs to give to the district court and to the litigants.
And I know you want to reserve your time. I'll make it quick. So I suppose another hypothetical is the transferees didn't intervene. So it's just the TMR, judgment against the TMR. Now it's at some level, I suppose, a contract dispute, perhaps an indemnity dispute between the TMR and the transferee. And the problem in that scenario is you have a judgment, but you have no mechanism that would let you go assert a deficiency against the transferee. Is that right? So you'd have a judgment against the donor for the tax. The transferees haven't intervened. Now they're a representative. Do you need us to decide what the issue of taxpayer is so that you can then go collect against the transferees?
Yes, because just to be clear, at the end of these cases, the judgment will be against any taxpayer who claimed a credit. It won't be against the donor unless the donor retained any portion of the credit. So in most of the cases, it'll be a judgment against a transferee who purchased and claimed the credit.
Oh, I see. So maybe I had it wrong. So the only party here is the TMR, but the judgment would be the transferee owes the money.
Correct.
All right. Well, I think that. Go ahead, Judge.
That's all right. You don't have much time left. We'll,
that's okay.
We'll respond
if you have
on
questions,
that.
I'd love to answer them.
The scenario that Judge Gabriel talks about, though, seems to me to raise an issue about when this statute became effective, because House Bill 1300 contemplates that the TMR will be able to bind the transferee. What about the transferees that had no knowledge of House Bill 1300 even coming forward? Can they be bound by a later enacted statute that says you're obligated to follow what the court says to the TMR?
So two points there. One is that the TMR transferee relationship actually came about in 2003, was effective in 2003. So it wasn't part of House Bill 11-1300. So those relationships pre-existed. And then now the transferees, it is important to note that the legislation did actually require the Department of Revenue by July 1st to issue a notice regarding the new legislation to all TMRs. And the department did send out notice of the options that are available to TMRs, both for district court and the administrative hearings.
What I'm concerned about is the transferees, though. Did your notice ever contact transferees when you sent out notices of deficiency?
The notice of deficiencies, yes. The bills were actually sent to the transferees, correct. Thank you.
Raise that podium if you need to. Toggle switch on your right on the top.
So I probably shouldn't giggle at that. Please, the court. My name is Billy Jones from Moy White. I'm bar number 35294. I'm here today representing the appellants below and the appellees here, who are 14 donors of conservation easement tax credits. If I may, I'd like to start with the question that was asked by Judge Webb about whether or not you are bound to reach the taxpayer definition issue.
Start with my earlier question. There's no reference to legislative history in your brief either. Do you agree that it's not helpful?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Go on.
The other point I wanted to make was that I do think that you can and you may choose to decide this case and remand it back to the district court without reaching the taxpayer definition question. And the reason for that, you have to understand the procedural context that this case arose in. My clients as designated TMRs have filed their notice of appeal. The first pleading we received back was the motion to dismiss from the state, and we got the ruling from the trial court judge. You know, this is not a case where there's been no factual findings, no discovery, there are no transferees as parties. I mean, we really are at the preliminary stages. The revenue has not even filed a responsive pleading yet. What Revenue is arguing is that a substantive bar to moving forward in our case is that we as TMRs are required to personally name as parties and serve all of the transferees. I think that when you look at this, the trial court judge obviously dealt with the taxpayer definition issue, but on the question of who needs to be a party to this proceeding and when, I think looking at the statute itself, its language with respect to transferees, the language on intervention, and the whole structure of the statute gives you the opportunity, if you choose to do so, to remand with an order that we are not required to name all transferees and serve them personally to proceed with our case without reaching the merits on the taxpayer issue. The statute itself, in its preamble, talks about efficiency, fairness, and judicial economy. In trying to come up with a system to deal with all of these claims, and there are a number of them out there, although this is a limited case with only 14 donors, but to do this in a way that is efficient and economical in the context of having to go through all these cases. In that context, what the statute does is it creates a tiered and phased system, which is intended, I think, when you read it as a whole, to make this a very efficient system. It starts with the designation of the TMR. You have a single party who's responsible, who binds and represents everyone's, with regard to issues like the validity of the credit, what was done, appraisal issues, and things like that. I think that shows a desire by the legislature to not have a proceeding where you have multiple parties asserting multiple positions on those core questions. And I think similar to a class action setup, which you, Judge Gabriel, mentioned, the legislature chose to have that single representative for those issues.
Can I play devil's advocate with you on that one, Mr. Jones? So you make a compelling argument that, you know, the intervention, you know, shows that the legislature didn't intend to have for the transferees to be indispensable. It would be superfluous. You would need an intervention. I have some concerns about the due process issues that this may raise. Let's say you're right. Let's assume for everything you said is right. The legislature clearly intended to have just TMR was going to be the representative. Transferees are bound.
Yes.
My problem here, unlike the class action example I posed, is they at least have to give notice to an absent class rep, and they've got a chance to opt out. Here, I don't see anything in the statute that requires notice to the transferee that you even have a right to intervene. It strikes me it would be an easier case if you had that, unless you could decide. But there's no notice to them at all. You could go through the whole thing, and a transferee never even know this happened. Why doesn't that create a due process issue?
We respond to that in three ways. I think, first of all, from the perspective of notice, you know, Revenue's conceded that they sent these transferees tax bills. So there is certainly a level of knowledge that you as a transferee have a potential tax problem with the state of Colorado. You know, second of all, there is a provision, at least in the way we've handled ourselves so far with the tax matters representative, that you do have a baseline notice option with your transferees that, hey, this is going on.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
It may be outside the record, but we've given notice to our transferees that this is going on. I think this is where the trial court's order, I think, comes into play, in that it's important to note that the trial court's order denying the motion to dismiss, not only dealt with the taxpayer issues and saying the transferees don't have to be parties, but adopted an argument that we've made below, which is something akin to a class action notice, saying, you know, as a requirement before we move forward, we're going to have an actual notice that goes out to transferees that advises them, hey, this is going on, your rights may be implicated, and that you have a right to intervene, again, referencing that part of the statute. I think from a due process perspective, due process is not necessarily having to be involved, it's notice and an opportunity. And something like that, which is what the trial court came down and said, this is what you're required to do to move forward, provides both notice and opportunity. I think it's a very simple system. It's something akin to what's used in other multi-party type litigation. It's something to be appropriate here, and we were in favor of doing that, you know, after we actually made the suggestion in the briefing. The other point, which I don't want to get lost in here with respect to the tiered system, is this. In this proceeding, the TMR and revenue will have these initial stages where they'll talk about eligibility for the credit, evaluation, go through some of these defenses. And one of the things about the arguments made by revenue is revenue assumes that in all these cases, there's going to be a problem with the easements. They assume that there's going to be a deficiency, and it's going to run into the donors or the transferees. When you look at the tiered system, it's designed in a way that you can efficiently deal with it and have an initial stage where revenue and the TMR, who in most cases would be the donor, who's in the best position to talk about the professionals we hired, the appraisals we got, everything that went into creating this, everything that will go to its validity. Those two parties can have their phases where they go through the validity of the easement. It's important to note that if at the end of that, those initial phases, the TMR prevails, there will be no deficiency. There will be no deficiency for the donors. There'll certainly be none for any transferees. And in fact, in that case, there's no need for the transferees to be a party at any point. There's no need to even bother them.
But if the converse is true, if the trial court says it's invalid, that clearly has a direct impact, an immediate impact on the transferee, does it not?
Well, it has an impact on them from this perspective. I mean, it certainly has an impact in that the revenue will assert that they have some amount of tax liability. Again, that gets down to valuation and how things are apportioned. We've made an argument under subsection 9, which we can talk about in more detail, that the statutory structure actually limits those deficiencies, penalties, and interest to not just taxpayers as defined, but particular type of taxpayers, those who have donated the easement. From a due process perspective, getting back to your point, I think, again, the statutory language, which designates that TMR as the party to both represent and bind them, means that for purposes of liability, should that flow to the transferees, they will be bound by that. Now, the statute also contemplates, after you go through these initial stages with revenue and the TMR, there are additional, it's difficult to talk in terms of phases, because actually when you count them up, they're somewhere between 4 or 6, depending on where you put the boundaries for the phases. But when you get towards those final phases, you know, if and when there's a need at that point to add transferees to litigate over their liability, there are a number of procedural avenues that are available to add them at the point, again, if it becomes necessary.
It's to prevent a transferee from coming in at the second phase and saying, I wasn't before the court, nor was I under the personal jurisdiction of the court in my personal capacity, as opposed to perhaps an agency, and saying, I would have asserted a different response to revenue's contention that this was an invalid conservation tax easement.
Two responses to that with one short precursor. You know, I represent donors, I don't represent transferees, so to a certain extent, making arguments about what may occur down the road, there may be other arguments transferees would make. However, number one, I think the fact that they would have received notice of the disallowance from revenue at an initial stage, they would have received some notice from the TMR and or the type of notice we were going to send out in this case before it came up to this court, it would be very difficult for them to claim a lack of notice or a lack of opportunity to participate. I think secondly, the fact of the matter is that they are, you know, the statute itself makes them bound by the determination as between revenue and the TMR. I think from a remedy perspective, if there is a problem that the taxpayer does have on its return, it's important to note that, as noted by revenue, at least in our situation, I would imagine in almost all, there are very expansive indemnity obligations which run from the transferees back to the donors, which were entered into at the time these transactions were consummated, such that to the extent there is liability at the transferee level, that can and likely would flow down to the donor through those indemnity obligations.
But under your interpretation, they'd have to do that in a subsequent or different lawsuit. It wouldn't be necessarily involved in this
one. No, it would be involved in this, but it would be involved in the final phase. And if you'll excuse me as I flip through, the actual final phase then contemplates directly all of the claims related to conservation easement tax credit, including those between and among the tax matters representative, transferees, and other parties claiming a tax credit in connection with the donation, and any third party joined. I'm looking at subsection, I believe, M, Roman numeral 3, in 39522-522.5. Again, and I think the fact that the legislature made a provision for at the end, once we've gone through the TMR revenue conflict over the easement itself and its validity, we've gotten to a point where presumably there is a problem with it, because again, if everything holds up on that course, there will be no liability to anyone. There's no need to move forward on any other claims. At that point, there's a provision for bringing in those people and sorting out those remaining claims, and I think that's where it occurs.
Now, you've referred to penalties, and there's a couple of references in the statute. Are any of these penalties unique to the conservation easement process, or are they simply the type of penalties that would be assessed by revenue for any underpayment of tax?
To my understanding, the penalties are not unique to this process. There would be standard penalties that are similar in any disallowance of a tax credit or other deficiency proceeding on the tax side. That's my understanding, Judge.
Is it your position that, let's say, a donor sold 100% of the conservation easement credit to another taxpayer, and the other taxpayer took that credit against its tax liability? Is it your position that revenue can nevertheless only assess that liability against the donor, even though the donor took no tax credits for it?
Judge, I think that, again, if you reach the definition of the taxpayer arguments, that is my position, and it's based on subsection 9 and the language therein.
I mean, isn't that kind of counterintuitive in terms of how tax law usually works?
I will fully admit that's counterintuitive, okay. Absolutely. However, I think what's important in that situation is that this is a situation where the legislature has put in a specific statutory section, subsection 9, which reiterates that in the specific context of conservation and tax easements. I think the statute says what it says, and because of what it says, through the specific language, it limits it not only to taxpayers as defined, but also to taxpayers who have, you know, who can claim an easement for the donation.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, I interrupted you. Finish your sentence.
No, I was going to say the language for the donation is a particular type of the taxpayer as defined, and that's what the statute says, and that's what we would ask, that's how we would ask that it be enforced.
And I apologize again for interrupting.
That's fine.
When the transferee claims the credit, isn't the transferee claiming the credit for the donation of the easement? I mean, isn't that what that's what they're seeking the credit for? It's not, I'm claiming a credit because you transferred it to me. It's, I'm claiming a credit because there was a donation of an easement.
Well, they're claiming credit because I bought the credit. I mean, that's what they're claiming.
But it was for the donation of
the economic reality of it. I think that language is not surplusage. I think one of the reasons is where the intent of that to be that anyone that has any credit that relates in any way to that, I think that it certainly could have said any taxpayer, any transferee. It certainly could have said anyone who claims tax credit related to any conservation easement. It didn't say that. And I think because of that, the language as written makes a distinction between taxpayers, the definition of taxpayer, but also makes a distinction as to those particular types of taxpayers against whom revenue can take action. I think also in this context, it's important to understand the donors are the ones who took all the actions that presumably revenue is challenging here. I mean, revenue is not taking action, at least in the majority of these cases, and saying, you know, there were transferees that either took credits and didn't buy them or were overstating their amounts or things like that. We're talking about a situation where after years have gone by, revenue has come back and said, hey, the economic substance of the transaction itself, we're going to disallow it in its entirety. And in order to vindicate your rights, you have the option of using this procedure, and now we're in a situation where what revenue is saying is, as a precondition to going in there and vindicating our rights as taxpayers, to take the credits, to prove that we did it in a valid and enforceable way, we're being prevented from doing that unless we're required to add these additional parties, which add nothing but further expense, add delay and hassle to the process in a way that runs contrary to the language of the statute and the particular structure that was set up here by the legislature.
I know your time is running out here, Mr. Jones. If you can address two things for me before your time runs. In subsection 1 of 522, what does as an entity mean to you? I mean, you kind of studiously didn't address that in your brief, I think. And then if you would tell me, 522.5N is the one that says the district court will hear the appeal in accordance with the rules of civil procedure.
Yes.
Why does Rule 19 not apply? if, once they've adopted.
I think this may be a situation, let me start at the end and I'll get back to your first question. I think it's a situation where in some ways our briefs may have been talking back to each other. I think the rules of civil procedure are incorporated herein, okay? However, I think that when the statute says intervention, not once but twice with reference to transferees, what the statute has done is define the role of these transferees in the proceeding as one of intervention for all the reasons that I've stated. I don't think it's a matter of Rule 19 suddenly couldn't apply under any scenario, but however, I think given the statutory structure, the express reference to intervention for the transferees, and the whole intent of the statute to do this efficiently, saying that just because Rule 19 may apply in certain circumstances, it's suddenly mandatory in all cases at its inception, goes well beyond the statutory structure and really represents a significant impediment to taxpayers vindicating their rights. Getting back to the first issue you raised, which was the statutory definition of taxpayer, the argument made at the trial court level, which the trial court agreed with, was that that clause does not only refer to the preceding language of the entity, but also that clause refers to all of the various types of taxpayers, individual partnerships, and otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Just 2 points here in response to Mr. Jones. One, I just want to make sure that we don't lose sight of the importance of you providing guidance to the district courts on the interpretation of the taxpayer definition and in subsection 1 and the language in subsection 9. I think it's helpful to keep in mind what the judgments in these cases will look like. If the transferees are not joined as parties, we will have a judgment in the case that assesses liability against individual transferee non-parties. So, and while Mr. Jones is right that the legislature could have included transferee in the language in subsection 9, it could have said any taxpayer including a transferee. It could have also said any taxpayer including an individual resident or a C corporation or a pass-through entity or a member of a donor pass-through entity. The legislature could have done that. What they did is they used the word any. And that has significance here. On the second point regarding intervention, this suggestion that somehow the right of intervention somehow supplants the rules under 12b6 and 19, there's just no support in the statute for that. The statute specifically incorporates all of the rules of procedure, and there's no reason to think that the right of intervention somehow supplants the finding that a party is a necessary party. These rules already coexist, and they work and serve different purposes. Rule 24 is addresses the intervener's rights, and Rules 19 and 12b6 address the existing parties, right? So they serve different purposes. And here intervention is just a safety net in the event that both the TMR and the Department of Revenue somehow fail to properly join a transferee. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for this afternoon. The bailiff may announce a recess.